Welcome to The Peg Doesn't Fit, the podcast that brings you the change makers in education. Tune in to hear from educational leaders who aren't content with the status quo educational model and are blazing their own path. Today on the show, we have Alec Resnick from Powder House School in Somerville, Massachusetts. He is, I believe, one of several co-founders of the school. Is that correct? Excellent.
That's right, yeah.
Yep, and it's a small S school, as I see on your website. Maybe you can explain to our listeners what that means. I know what it is because I've read John Hart's work, but just go ahead.
Yeah, that's a great,
go
great
start from there.
Point. Yeah. So John Holt was one of the first folks for each of the three co-founders of Sprout, which became Powder House, who kind of turned us on to even just the broader idea that people have really thought about education or critiqued it, which obviously sounds naive at this point, but at the time we were just, you know, in college studying not education things. Mm-hmm. In one of his books, I think it's Instead of Education, if I remember correctly, he talks about making the distinction between uppercase S school and lowercase S school. And he's trying to get at a cluster of differences, but among them are capital S school being like school, the institution, where you go to get taught, not necessarily where you learn, where you
right.
go for other people to do things to you, where you go for focus on kind of producing right answers as opposed to thinking about problems and kind of the, you know, institutional educational complex that creates a lot of the sometimes bad habits and bad postures and kind of develops the sometimes negative self-concepts that he often critiques in the rest of his work as a contrast to what might be possible if you take kind of non-coercive perspectives more seriously.
Ooh, I like that. Is he, would you say he was one of your inspirations or how did you even get to this point where you're at now? And our listeners don't probably even know where that is, what Powder House is.
Sure.
I know maybe take us back from when you first started teaching to how did you mm-hmm. get to this point? What made For you sure. go, wait a minute, school is small S, you know?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, like I was mentioning, I started an organization that was called Sprout at the time with two other co-founders of mine, and we had all met while we were in school at MIT. And coming from different kind of angles, we all got interested in some mixture of education, the social and political problems that education is often at the center of, and the role of education in community and community organizing and formation. And coming from different kind of perspectives, we were like, we want to do something in education. And so at the time, the way that initially started was actually at the time, we were really excited about the ideas, not only of folks like John Holt, but also I think two of the other more prominent thinkers in our, I suppose, early inspiration were Seymour Papert and Ivan Illich, who we can talk more about. But uh-huh. among other things, at the kind of intersection of some of those folks' ideas is this idea that's embedded in the big and small S distinction, which is that learning is different than teaching. Learning is something that happens throughout your life and certainly not just in school. Mm-hmm. And so somewhat inspired by that, very early on, we were very interested in enriching kind of the educational capacity of everyday life. So as opposed to creating a place that you went to learn, how could we go to where people were and were already living their lives and make that deeper intellectually, creatively, or otherwise? And so initially that started with a handful of kind of essentially public design projects where we would take interests that people already were pursuing in their lives, things like gardening or board games or whatever, uh-huh. and sometimes partner with other organizations, sometimes run our own programs where we were trying to kind of go deep on those, connecting them to a broader set of sometimes academic, sometimes technical, sometimes creative and other kind of ideas that you might not normally find there. And after about a year or so of that, we found basically that we weren't making enough money doing that. And so we started thinking about running more programming, more explicit programming that wasn't just like these kind of design projects where we would maybe partner with one organization and do something, but where people were coming to us and working with us over a more extended period of time. And so one of our co-founders, we had all had experience doing youth work, but Nagel, one of our co-founders, had run a pretty successful kind of arts and science summer camp, broadly inspired by the free school tradition. And so we started with mm-hmm. after-school programs and out-of-school programs and summer camps where we were trying to bring some of these perspectives to bear. And for years, our, I guess, kind of business model was about a quarter of the programs that we ran worked with either wealthier public school districts or independent schools who could afford to pay us, and everyone else might cover materials, but didn't pay essentially for the programs at the time. And for reasons I have to go into, we had decided that we didn't want to have to rely on grants to keep the lights on at first. And so we had a lot of flexibility in how we approached just the design questions that we were exploring. So we were fortunate to be in a position to mostly focus on sorting out our own pedagogy and figuring out a lot of the just practical questions that come up when you do this kind of work. And then a few years into that, we started finding that as we were partnering with schools, we would run programs, they would go very well, and then we would find that they kind of plateau in terms of how much we were learning from them. And over time, we realized that even if they were going well, that plateauing was coming in part from just the structural constraints that different schools face, often centered on things like schedule or budget or like curriculum commitments and things like that. And so we started thinking, rather than leaving those schools in the lurch, how could we both run new programs and also start to kind of pass those programs off to those schools? So we started doing more professional and curriculum development, and that was very successful. And after a few years of that, actually the mayor in Somerville approached us about this idea of starting a new in-district public school in a high school here in Somerville. And we would later learn that that happened at the behest of a handful of families whose kids had participated in our programs and really enjoyed them and advocated the mayor on our behalf. And
Excellent.
somehow actually, yeah, so it was very, so, we'd been in Somerville for maybe 7 years, 6, 7 years at that point. So it was great to have folks have that kind of validation of the work. And that was coming on the heels of a pretty divisive charter school fight that had been ongoing for maybe 2 or 3 years at the time. And for reasons I'm happy to go into, when we had started what was then Sprout, we had been very explicit about never wanting to start a school. But we hadn't anticipated, I think, one of the biggest issues, which is that in our kind of work, we're very interested in youth designing and developing their own projects. And in our after school and out of school programs, we might be working with somebody for 3 to 5 hours a week for, say, 12 to 16 weeks. And that means that you're spending maybe 30 to 50 hours with somebody. And depending on the context, they're, not necessarily their best hours, right? They might come at the end of the day, they might be stressed, they might not even want to be in the after school program in the first place. Their parents are keeping them there for childcare purposes. There are all these other factors. And we were finding there are these two big issues. One was 30 to 50 hours is just not that much time to do deep projects. Like that's like a work week for most of us if we're lucky.
Correct.
And then maybe even more importantly, as a kind of after out of school program provider, you're in a somewhat awkward position to kind of do anything about anything else that's happening in somebody's life. So even if you find out that there's some issue at home that might benefit from support or care, you're in a weird position to do much about it as some random after school or out of school provider. So even though we had this kind of prior commitment to not starting a school, we luckily the mayor persisted and he was suggesting that we start the school under what was called the Innovation Schools legislation in Massachusetts, which is basically a kind of legislation that allows districts to start more flexible or autonomous schools and offers a mechanism by which they can get flexibility or relief from various statutes or regulations that people associate with traditional schools, ranging from like graduation requirements to like the staff structure to schedule, all sorts of stuff. So we took a closer look at the legislation and realized that theoretically, at least, the degree of autonomy and flexibility we could get, we thought might actually be able to let us continue doing the kind of work we were excited about, despite our kind of prior impressions that school might not just be able to do what to accommodate the kind of interests that we had. So that started what grew into a multi-year, like 6 year process of a mixture of community organizing and piloting our work and getting various approvals, negotiating with the union, et cetera, which for 99% of it went great, was slow, but went great. And then on the eve of the approval of the school, the superintendent, Mary Skipper, basically changed their mind at the last minute and said, actually, I no longer support this, and kind of sunk the proposal.
No.
And so we can talk more about the kind of inside baseball and politics about it, if that's interesting. But that was a couple of years ago. So that was March 2019. And we were very fortunate because along the way, not only did we develop a bunch of community support, but we had raised money and connected with other foundations and like really learned a lot both about the internals of schools and districts, but also kind of the external scene of education reform and the various philanthropies and other organizations that support that. And fortunately, a handful of the folks that had been supporting our work up until that point wanted to continue to support it. Some of them wanted us to try again. Some were interested in us doing kind of curriculum development and professional development to take our lessons elsewhere. And that really gave us the time over the course of the past couple of years to figure out mostly strategically, what should we make of the rejection? So if you kind of imagine, I suppose, reading the case study about Powder House Studios that ends on the night of the vote of the school committee where we're rejected, and you wake up the next morning and you think, like, that was a seems like a great mission and organization. Obviously, the team screwed something up. What new organization do you start the next day? So we were very lucky, especially in the context of the pandemic, to have the time and space to begin to answer that. And so we can talk more about kind of some of our bigger answers to that, but one concrete piece of it was we decided, yes, we still want to start a school, but maybe for reasons I'm happy to go into, the districts can't be the right vehicle for the kind of experimentation we're interested in. But our long-term interest is still in public education. And that implies, I think, a couple commitments. One is working with the full breadth and diversity of folks that public schools serve. And two is doing that affordably, like doing that in a way that could remotely, plausibly one day, be supported by the financial structures that are in place to support school these days. And so we raised some money to establish a tuition-free independent school that will mirror the financial and legal constraints that public school faces, and will give us kind of the sandbox that we think is required to both demonstrate and hopefully validate our model, but also a platform for other kinds of activism we're interested in pursuing in the future. And so in doing that, we kind of took some inspiration from in other fields. There's often infrastructure for prototyping or invention. So, if you look in a field like technology, you have kind of storied corporate research labs like Bell Labs or Xerox PARC. In medicine, you have places like the Mayo Clinic. And something that I think is important about many of those places is that they actually build and use the things that they're prototyping and inventing. They don't just design them on paper and then ask somebody currently in the field to try to build it and get it to work. And I think education, for a lot of different reasons, doesn't really have that kind of setup. So most of the folks who might want to change education by building products or doing research often have to do so by either selling into or persuading existing schools or policymakers to fully adopt or adapt the way that they work, which is obviously important work, but kind of precludes certain more structural reinventions or questions that we're interested in, at least. And so what that means that we're doing now is that starting in the summer, we started prototyping our programs, and just now in the beginning of September, launched our first gap year program. It's a full-time program for youth where we're trying out our full-time model, basically. And the plan over the course of the next few years is to grow that program younger to create a full kind of high school replacement. So we're now in the, second week of that program, which brings us to now. And maybe I'll pause here since I've been talking for a while.
So the one you're referring to is the Kindling Fellowship, correct?
That's right. That's right. That's what we called it, mostly because we didn't come up with a better name by the time we needed to launch it. So.
Well, I like, at least for me, it evokes feelings of like a, the groundwork, so to speak, of a fire that you need, and then
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's like
that's
Powder House is
exciting.
nice. It's like not too aggressive. It's not like explosive. It's warming. It's, it has some nice properties, but it doesn't roll off the tongue.
And that addresses two different age groups. Is that what I saw? Like a young adult and then a another.
That's right. So in the summer, we had done an adult program for folks who were in college and just out of college. And we were mostly just prototyping a few kind of the workflows and basics of the program because we had added this emphasis on publication, which I didn't mention, but we can talk about if it's interesting. And we just wanted to get some experience facilitating around that. And then starting in September, we started this gap year program with a handful of folks who are just out of high school. And assuming that that goes reasonably, hopefully next year we would launch a junior senior program and the year after kind of a freshman sophomore program. So in our model, we
Excellent.
don't have grade levels, but we'd be basically getting younger.
Those are good ones. Well, so when you say you don't have a grade levels, I wanted to dive into that idea first because I am in public education, but yet I want sometimes I don't know, should I say I'm stuck in public education or I'm trying to do some of the same things that you're doing and like you testing to see can it work. And I've just recently, I'll say my fall down the rabbit hole was a long gradual one, and then all of a sudden it just plummeted down when I found
Oh,
the right
yeah.
authors like John Holt, John
Oh,
Taylor
interesting.
Gatto, and all and those Carrie McDonald. That's how I found out about you was
Oh, yeah, of course.
I listened to her Unschooled book this summer, and I was just totally fascinated by all this stuff. So,
Yeah, that's lovely.
I think I don't know which of those authors I just mentioned. I think it was maybe John Holt said that education, as we know it today, the capital S school, is practically a religion to the point where there's a lot of pushback if you even mention altering parts of that structure or that system. And some of it is just, legally embedded in bureaucratic systems too, that are unrelated to maybe what you call that religious aspect. However, the belief system around it and those two and that other legalistic aspect really hold a lot of tight constraints. And within that, because it's so big and massive, a lot of us have grown up in that system. So I have a feeling that a lot of listeners right now are thinking, okay, if it doesn't look like school, what does it look like? So I send my kid to Alex's school, to Powderhouse. What is their day going to look like? So what would you tell them?
Well, I think it depends on how old people are. So the day looks different when somebody might be 16 or 17 than when they're 12 or 13. So high school is obviously a pretty broad span. But I think one way that we talk about it, at least, is that if we're interested in people doing real work, the question is really, how do you manage that work? So I think in a traditional work environment, for example, the day of a junior and a senior colleague might look very different in the sense of, do they have a manager checking on them? How do they decide what they're working on that quarter? Like, are they, getting together with their team at the end of the day? Are they setting, year-long strategy? And people make their way through that organization largely through a model of apprenticeship, even if they don't call it that, right? Like you learn from your senior colleagues and from the rest of your team while you're working on problems. And I think that that's a big inspiration for us, because I think that whether it's in a research lab or graduate school or in kindergarten when younger kids are learning from slightly older kids or people who have slightly more skill in one area or another, we think that model of apprenticeship or being around people who are doing work that you might be interested in doing is important. So then I think it raises lots of just concrete questions, like you're asking about, of like, okay, but what does it actually mean for the day? So for us, I think something we very quickly ran into is, if you're doing projects people are interested in and you're kind of, quote, covering the full range of skills and knowledge that people are often worried about school developing in folks, you almost immediately have to give up on the idea of subject-based classes, because most working on projects in 40 or 50-minute classes is possible, but it's very, very painful and very hard in our experience. And so you end up with a kind of very simple structure of like morning and lunch and afternoon in terms of the time. And then the question is like, okay, but then how do you arrange kids if it's not by subjects moving one at a time? And again, in our experience, it's, the maybe not the physics of human development exactly, but it's that both in public school and generally, you just have kids working on projects, and one adult can't manage 20 or 30 kids. They can almost definitely manage five, somewhere between, in our experience, in the neighborhood of like 9 to 12, depending on who's in the room and the skill of the facilitator. An adult can deal with that. And so, for a variety of reasons I'm happy to go into, the way we've organized the school is, or the model is, that we have cohorts of 30 to 40 mixed age youth who are kind of managed by a group of four adults that stay with them for their, 4+ years with us over the course of their time at Powderhouse. And that group comes together in the morning, and early on in somebody's career in Powderhouse, I mean, they might be participating in more structured interdisciplinary programs, which I can describe, that are meant to help people get acquainted with how you develop ideas for projects, pitch those projects, structure your time, and tackle those projects. But the hope is, by the time that somebody's leaving Powderhouse, they're spending most of their time in more independent settings. That doesn't have to mean alone, but where instead of the, say, the theme of a program offering the structure that helps them come up with the idea for a project, it might be their personal interests or career interests or academic interests that are doing that. But the schedule structure and the, I suppose, staff structure doesn't change. What changes is the what those adults are facilitating, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. They've
So there are a
moved.
lot of details within that in terms of, how do you document stuff for transcripts? How do you handle special education? We can talk about the specifics of the schedule, but at a high level, it's morning, lunch, afternoon. You're working on projects. Those projects grow in scope over the time that you're with us at Powderhouse, and they both grow in scope, and they grow in hopefully how individualized they are and how individual a set of interests they reflect.
Okay. Do you, well, a lot of, and with my past guests, we have focused on this idea of like the parent or the educator concern of graduation, so to speak. And I know you can't see me, but I put them in little quotes.
Sure.
What what do I do? How do I, you said transcripts, like how do you justify to a college-bound child, or even maybe they're going into a tech school or going straight into an apprenticeship, like how do you record, justify the learning? Do you have pushback from those institutions, or has it been fairly smooth for translating that learning? What does that look like?
So maybe starting with that second half of how the institutions have responded, at least in our experience, institutions are much more flexible and open-minded than most families and even districts, I think, give them credit for, largely because most of these institutions have already had to deal with the long tail of youth's lives. Like, there are already folks that go to weird independent schools, or who are homeschooled, or who are coming from another country. There are already people who are edge cases in one way or another. And even the most traditional, like, or large scale state system schools know how to relate to that. They might be more or less interested in the texture of your experience. Like, a large state system might say, as long as you have a good SAT score and you can give us something that looks like a GPA, it's fine. Whereas a smaller college might be like, yeah, I am interested in all your narrative evaluations and things like that. The difference is not so much in how open the institutions are, but I think it's much more about how families and youth, their mental model of those institutions, mental models, if that makes any sense.
Of course, yes.
But in terms of concretely what that means for us in terms of generating a transcript, part of the way that we think about our role is a little bit, I suppose, more like whatever your stereotype of a family doctor or religious advisor or lawyer might be, which is to say that we're experts that help you figure out what you're interested in, design projects or experiments to engage that, do those on larger and larger timescales, building the skills and connections you might need to make your next transition. For some folks, that next transition might be into a career. For some, it might be into college. For different colleges, there might be different requirements or expectations. And the way that we think about that is there's, some long list of personal and professional interests, academic requirements, special education or English language learning needs. And we should be kind of thinking about that list of things at all times and helping people come up with projects that connect to those. Sometimes those things might not, for different reasons, maybe youth don't want to learn this subject that they're not that interested in through a project, but they do want a traditional transcript. So maybe our role is to help them connect to a local community college class or to find a good online option where we can play more of the role of a tutor or a guide with a more traditional pedagogy. But hopefully, for the majority of the skills that might show up in a traditional set of graduation requirements, they feel like they have the space and we feel like we have the capacity to help them develop projects or other kinds of experiences that engage those. And so I think the most maybe important or fundamental part of our approach around that is that I think at least a lot of the other schools that we're familiar with that might fall under the umbrella of quote project-based learning, there's still this process of going from a set of standards to designing a project that in some sense quote covers them. And for reasons I'm happy to go into, I don't think that works or is like sustainable within a school on a normal schedule and stuff like that. And so what we end up doing is we help people come up with projects and we deepen those, and then we retrospectively map that work back onto a mixture of traditional academic standards, so specifically Common Core math and ELA, but also personal and professional goals, special education goals, et cetera. So it's a little bit like driving by looking in the rearview mirror, where you're looking at what people have done. You're saying, oh, now we have kind of some evidence that somebody's developed these skills. And for different kinds of skills, you might also be in a position to at some point say, and if you want to demonstrate capacity for a more traditional stakeholder, maybe you're interested in taking something like the SAT at some point, or in a public school setting, you'd be at some point thinking of, in Massachusetts, the MCAS, the state standardized tests. And so there are some particular flexibilities that we think are accessible that make those concerns much less salient or much less of a pressure than I think many people normally think of, like high stakes testing as applying to school models. So we can talk about that if that's interesting. But the basic idea is you do stuff, and then you look at what you could say that you've learned, and then you keep doing that. And whatever you haven't learned that is either part of a graduation requirement or some other kind of goal, you either think about designing products that target those things more specifically, or you look for other options in an individualized way.
Do you think that that is possible in a public education setting?
100%. I do. I mean, so obviously the proof is in the pudding, and you should talk to me again in 4 or 5 years, and we can show you the whole setup.
Of course.
But at least in our experiences doing this kind of thing in programs, it certainly is. You do have to, there are plenty of trade-offs and sacrifices that you have to make that maybe certain public schools aren't willing to make. But if you're asking, is it possible from a legal and financial point of view, I 100% think that it is. I think that the biggest obstacles that schools face are much more cultural and to a lesser extent, kind of human capital in terms of the skills, perspective, and training that that staff have. So.
Well, that feels good to hear because I believe it's possible. I feel like
Yeah.
this, I'm at a very small school. We have 104 students, grades 6 through 12. And
Yeah.
I just came from a large urban school where we had 800 kids, grades 6 through 8. And it's quite a dramatic change. But I think
For sure.
when you hit a certain size, I know there's definitely some flexibility, and I'm excited to try that out.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting to just think about sometimes we in the educational religion of largest school, not large S, but what a funny word. The large S, capital S schools, we will get in hung up on this idea of, well, they need to stay in the grade level or they need to stay in the
For
content
sure.
area because how do I know if they got the content? You know,
For sure.
mastered the skills, yet the ironic, I guess, or sad truth of it is a kid can tune out or dismiss or
Of
not
course.
learn those skills with the same success rate as skip, you know, doing this other method in which they
Absolutely.
actually learned a lot of things they wanted and maybe they didn't get everything, but at least they were engaged.
Sure.
And what a win.
Yeah,
So.
that's right. Absolutely. No, I think that's 100% right. And I think that in general, it's kind of frustrating that it, at least in our experience in the political economy of school reform or starting new schools or whatever, it's often, at least we have found very little success trying to point out what's the de facto performance of existing schools, because, you know, it can sound like low expectations. It can sound like critique of school. Even if those things are true, it's often hard to advocate from that place. But I think you're 100% right that, you know, in many ways, I think m many people, for example, who think I'm not a math person and have blocked from their memory almost everything that they quote learned in school would have been better off having great experiences with math and mathematical thinking that didn't align with the standards and being quote ignorant of the things that school was supposed to teach them, but being open and excited and curious than the position they're in now, which is, I think, for many people, like I never want to see it again, even if they quote covered it at some point in history.
Right. You potentially burn the bridge is not the right word, but
That's right.
spoil a kid on a certain standard when
Absolutely.
had they been fascinated about, you know, I don't know, blowing up some toys because that sounded like a fun experiment, you could learn about chemistry, math, physics, all of
For sure.
that as a result of that. And that's I think we missed some opportunities there.
If not the goal is like, you know how, okay, sorry.
I'm pretty excited because I've gotten at least a couple of my teachers to start down this path because they have just about 3 kids in a room. And
That's
it's
lovely.
interesting. I'm actually curious to hear if the students that come to you out of traditional school, if they have a struggle bus period, so to speak. Because the three that I'm experimenting with here, and we're only like 3 weeks into school, like you are, they when they're asked, "What do you want to learn about?" It's kind of like this wall that you can see on their face, like, "Wait, what do you mean? I want you to tell me." And then we had another
Yeah, of
girl that's
course.
going totally on this amazing project of making her own apple cider vinegar. She's made
Oh, yeah.
corn stuff. She's just fascinated by 1800s fermentation and food storage.
That's
So
very sweet.
we're going with it. But then the other day she's like, I don't know what to do. I feel like I need structure. So the other day she made herself an assignment in which she needed to read a book and take some notes and fall back into that. And so anyway, back to my question for you. Do your students struggle that come from traditional to like adjust to this freedom?
Yeah, for sure, in different ways. And it's, I think it's been a question that we've kind of grappled with in different ways over the years because, you know, in this community, there are some folks who might name the process of like unschooling or deschooling as like a necessary and painful phase of adaptation and transformation to get to the point where you feel like I'm independent and self-possessed and responsible for my time and so on. And I think that's certainly true. And we've just rarely been in a situation where we can afford to incur those costs basically for everyone involved. Because in like the unschooling and deschooling community, people are opting into that, right? So in different ways, families and sometimes youth see like, oh, there's this hard transition. I'm choosing to leave for certain reasons. And in a lot of our work, in an after-school, out-of-school context, people are in a different headspace. And I think that question doesn't come up as much, though it still does. And then in the context of the work we've been doing in more recent years, when people are looking at kind of school replacements, not everyone involved understands the gravity or the scale of the transformation or the transition that they're undertaking. And so we've started to think more about how do you stretch that transition out so that it doesn't feel so dramatic for folks, mm-hmm. especially because over the years we've found ourselves realizing, at least in my opinion, that I think the sometimes kind of caricatured mental model of kids or people have interests inside of them, and all you have to do is like figure out what those are and then do those with people. Uh-huh. That's certainly true for some people, but in my experience, people are very motivated by the social context they're in and what they're even aware that they could be interested in. And and in fact, just asking people what they're interested in doesn't answer enough of the question of like, well, you know, who decides what they get exposed to? How do they get exposed to new things? You know,
yeah.
if you want to learn something because your crush is into it, like, is that an intrinsic or extrinsic motivation?
Yeah.
So I think there's just a lot of muddiness in it. And so the struggle that we, the kinds of struggles we run into more frequently, I think, end up being much more about the bad habits that school develops when it comes to just doing creative work in the first place, right? So some of that's about people who come in with a like a muscle memory about how they relate to authority figures or structure or suggestions. Mm-hmm. Some of that's about people who come in and, you know, they're used to constantly asking like, is this right? Is this right? Is this enough?
Right.
Like doing the quote bare minimum. So there are all these kinds of habits, or even if they're interested in this stuff, they just haven't had enough experience doing work to like develop all the other skills, whether it's metacognitive or executive function. You know, there's a bunch of stuff that goes into being a just productive and creative person, even if you know exactly what you're interested in,
mm-hmm.
much less if you're unclear on that. And so I think those are some of our bigger challenges. And that's where we, I think, have benefited a lot from these analogies to the workplace, where, again, I think you're thinking about, you know, just how do you scaffold a junior colleague to figure out like what their responsibilities are, or how they can contribute, mm-hmm. or, you know, I think there are a lot of parallel questions. And we've gained a lot from trying to adapt those kinds of the structures that you might find in a creative workplace to a youth environment.
I love it. Well, I think we could talk for hours and hours here. I wish I had my video on. I figured out my idea for what I could have done to get me on video, but too late for that today.
Next time.
Yep. I want to wrap it up with two questions.
Okay.
You already answered one of them in a sense, which is you said public schools absolutely, yes, can do this.
Yep.
My question is, where do we start?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm of kind of two minds, so I'll share both mm-hmm. kind of like, I don't know if it's a vision, but both directions. So on the one hand, I think that what's really important and part of what motivates our work is just to show people that it is in fact possible.
Yeah.
So like right now, I think there's a lot of really great stuff happening in the independent school world, the homeschooling world, and all sorts of different kind of like things on the margin.
Yeah.
And I think that for a bunch of different reasons, public school is an education reform, maybe writ more largely, is not that good at looking at those things and saying, oh, we can learn something from those, because they very quickly, at least in my experience, they're like, well, of course you can do X in setting Y because you don't have constraint Z and
right.
the different values for all those things. And
uh-huh.
that's often true. Like there are plenty of independent schools that have like a budget or a school population or whatever, which enables certain things. But that doesn't mean there's not something to learn. And so one of the things we've kind of come to the conclusion of is that even if a lot of the things that we believe are already, quote, known or demonstrated in certain places, or people have written about them or whatever, as far as we know, there isn't a school that meets all the financial and legal constraints public school has to face that you can invite, maybe not the most skeptical principal, but just like a median superintendent. They should be able to come in, take a tour, and they shouldn't be able to point to anything and say like, well, of course you can X because Y, whereas we have to Z. So I think that thinking about how do you create infrastructure so that some kind of experimentation and prototyping can happen so that we can end up with some of those examples, I think that's very important. So that's where I think we draw a lot of inspiration from these analogies to like R&D labs, like I was mentioning earlier, thinking, you know, maybe every district doesn't need one, but
mm-hmm.
certainly every, you know, 3 to 5 districts maybe should, or every state maybe, right, should have one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if across 50 states, you had, 50 community college-like institutions devoted to, kind of in certain ways reviving the idea of a laboratory school. And even if only 10% of those bore fruit, all of a sudden you'd have a bunch of very interesting schools, not just for people to visit and learn from, but I think even more importantly, just to establish that it is in fact possible. Because I kind of think about, have you ever seen these graphs of like the, world record for running certain distances and things like that, where as soon as one person runs the 4-minute mile, then all of a sudden a ton of people can run the 4-minute mile. The important thing is clearly establishing like, oh, it's possible. It's something we can aim for. So I think that that's one part, one piece that's interesting and important is thinking more about how do we establish this infrastructure for invention and experimentation in addition to the infrastructure for improving stuff and supporting the things that already exist. And then the other kind of frame of mind I'm in sometimes is like that we need to take a much more activist approach, right? That in Somerville, for example, almost one out of five of everyone who could register did. And still that wasn't enough for the school committee to just say, like, you know what, you're right. You should be able to do this. Like a group of 30 kids should be able to do this. And so sometimes I'm of the mind that maybe we need to be thinking in more kind of like activist capacities,
I
where
see.
as opposed to kind of assuming that the question is not technocratic exactly, but like if only we could show people the model and think about like the pedagogy parts of it, which are obviously important. Sometimes I think the questions maybe are more political, and the questions are like, well, let me say it this way. I think everyone who cares about these questions in the public school space should have an answer to the following. How many families of a appropriately broad and diverse background, like socioeconomically and demographically, how many have to come together and say, I want something different before the kind of public system just has to give it to them? I think very few people would say one. I think people understand how complex it is to accommodate every individual family's needs. But I think kind of trivially, if 100% of families say they want something, they can just like, vote out the school committee and vote in a school committee that is going to do what they want. So somewhere in between those two numbers, you should have an answer for, when are we allowed to do something, whether or not the school committee or whether or not the state or, whatever the appropriate kind of authorizer or stakeholder is, and under what conditions? Because I think a lot of the folks who might be suspicious or dubious of, say, people who support vouchers or education savings accounts is I think they often don't hear from that crowd a concern for issues of equity or socioeconomic stratification. And like I think that's an important conversation to have, but it's very hard to have in the very like you're either pro or anti-public school. Like it's very was very confusing for us to be sometimes mistaken for people who are anti-public school, even though the thing that animates us is the public in public education. So I think so all that's to say that sometimes I wonder whether what we need is actually a much more like political and cultural shift, not so much a pedagogical shift. Obviously, eventually we need both, but in terms of like what next, I feel like we're often split in our feelings about which of those two directions to pursue.
I don't know. It sounds to me like it's a chicken and egg problem, or maybe it's just you got to do both. I find how it is interesting in a almost a religious or political reaction when I hear public educators talk about even charter schools, which are
That's right.
public, they are public schools still. Yet
No,
they rail against them like, no, they're dishonest, shady, what all this stuff. And it's like, yeah, but that's a public school. It's stuff. And anything that goes away from like public school sounds almost anti immediately to a lot of people, which is too bad. And even when you say families, I think that's a good way to hear their voice. Actually, in Kansas right now, there's a, and maybe it's in other states too, there's this potential Parents' Bill of Rights, they are
Oh,
calling it.
yeah. Oh, interesting. I hadn't heard about that.
And I think as a business, which we ultimately are, you would want to hear from the parents, like you said, your families. Yet, and is what I understand this bill is set out to do. Yet
Interesting.
there's a lot of resistance, like, wait, if you had this, parents are going to try to tell us what to do. And I think, well, if I owned a grocery store, my customers would come suggest, hey, could you add this kind of cheese? I really liked it. And I wouldn't be like, how dare they come and tell me what to put in my store? Yet we do that in education. So that's just, there's a lot of entrenched resistance and maybe closed-mindedness on all sides. You know, if I'm totally anti-public education, I'm not going to be open to a lot of things that even
Of
resemble moving
course.
that
Yeah, no,
way.
I think that's right. And I think that's part of why we draw some inspiration from analogies like family doctors or lawyers or religious advisors, where it's a coming together. Because I think an advantage that the grocery store has is that the interaction is very short and it's very clean. It's like, you don't carry the product I want. I'm going to go somewhere else this week. And with kids, I think it's just much longer and messier.
It
Like, it's
is.
rare that you're purchasing like a 20-minute experience. You're purchasing often like a year experience, at least for most families. And so that's why I feel like there's these like still I don't know, still free association and still open channels of communication. But you have like a open channel for kind of talking about, is this what my kids should be learning? How are they doing? It's like a relationship that's about kind of your, I suppose, like fiduciary in one way or another responsibility. And I think that requires a big shift in school, because I think when a lot of teachers or principals imagine a bunch of dissatisfied parents coming saying, you should use this curriculum, or why are we learning this? Or even without getting into the culture war quote stuff,
And in
they're
fact,
like,
they
oh,
could be
I'm
engaged and
already,
excited.
yeah, exactly. I think they feel like I'm already so overwhelmed. So of course we have to re we do have to restructure, I think, the just relationship and schedule that, building leaders and teachers have to accommodate those new kinds of relationships.
I did read a fascinating article about it was the just a thought experiment of what if our schools, what if your school was the same as your grocery store, or grocery store was the same as your school? Like you were stuck with the grocery store that was in your neighborhood,
Oh, I see.
and that wasn't earlier, that wasn't the grocery store reference I was meaning, but in
Yeah,
that
no,
same
definitely.
line. It's like we wouldn't accept that. We like to drive to whatever
Of
grocery
course.
store fits us. But yet with schools, you're stuck with your neighborhood school, essentially,
That's right.
and
That's right.
you have no say in it, and you hope for the best, and that's kind of where we're stuck.
Yeah, and it's part of what's it's unfortunate that in contrast to it's just the word public gets very muddy. Like, I
It
think it'd be
does.
nice. Medicare for all, for example, I think is something many people support and see as a public moving in the public direction in medicine. But if you translate that analogy to education, that's essentially, education insurance would look something like vouchers or education savings accounts. You're not stuck with the doctor that's around the corner from you.
Correct.
And that all of a sudden sounds like a very radical or right wing or like anti-public question. And so I just think I don't know how to create the kind of space you need to have that civic
To
conversation.
be open to it,
But
yeah.
just what even public means, I think, is often a big point of disagreement when different parties are talking past each other.
Oh yeah, you're totally right. I hadn't even thought about that. Thank you.
Yeah, of course.
So just want to follow up with the last one. Who do you feel influenced by, or what? How do you stay kind of mentally innovative, maybe? And then also, I want to hear how can our listeners check on what you're doing, follow
Oh,
you,
sure.
et cetera.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, second question's easy. Powderhouse.org. We're all on the various social networks and stuff, and you can follow us there as well. In terms of kind of personal professional influences, how do we stay like activated? I suppose I'd say there are like maybe two buckets. So one is we're constantly excited about looking at where people are doing creative work in the world. So forget about youth for a second and just think about like new tools, communities, business models, activities, where I feel like choose anything, things are often getting so much cheaper, more affordable, more powerful. Like people are doing just cool stuff, whether that's in like music or art or movie production or whatever. And I think we find it very generative to think, okay, the amateurs in those fields, how far is that experience from a young person who's interested in that? And what kind of extra tooling or facilitation or materials would you need to, adapt the novice movie maker experience to a novice youth movie maker experience? And how might you begin to connect that to some of the quote traditional academic, challenges or questions or skills that schools often worried about? So we get a lot, I think, of inspiration from looking outside of education and but looking at the novice experience across different fields. And then I think the other is that we get a lot of inspiration from, I suppose, like older, I often experience them as more radical thinkers or proposals or in education reform, ranging from like traditional quote classics like John Dewey that I think are really underappreciated. But I think three of the other thinkers that might have left some of the most unique marks on us, we've mentioned briefly of John Holt, and Ivan Illich and Seymour Papert in different ways that I'm happy to go into. But I'd encourage everyone. I think
Check
we're
them
all
out.
underappreciated and are worth checking out for sure.
I have not heard of Seymour Papert or Ivan Illich. Are they
Yeah.
also, are they professors? Are they authors? Do they have a book out that we should check
Yeah, yeah.
out?
Yeah. All of them have passed away. So they do all have books. Both Seymour Papert was a professor. Ivan Illich started out as a priest and became kind of an author, philosopher, polemicist. One of his more famous books is called Deschooling Society. Another really valuable one is called Tools for Conviviality. And he's often talking about the cultural and social role that education plays, not just thinking about pedagogy, but thinking about like politics and human development and communities and how we define progress, all sorts of very, I think, powerful stuff. And then Seymour Papert was at the Media Lab for quite some time at MIT. And among other things, might be best known for a programming language called Logo that he developed, that was originally intended as a programming language accessible to kids, but was also a programming language meant to explore how can programming change how we talk about what we think and how we learn, using kids as like one of the first maybe, model systems or examples to explore that. And I think he has this very beautiful idea. It's not just about the technical fields that he worked in of like math and programming, where I think he has a lot to offer, but also just the broader idea that we should maybe more regularly and intentionally revisit what we learn and like the powerful ideas we care about, not just how we attempt to teach it. So, his example, he really cared about, and as we do, the role of tools and technology in learning. And I think something that's kind of tragic is that oftentimes when new technologies are developed, the first question is, how can they help school? So it's like you see incredible technologies used to teach the quadratic equation or to turn like lectures into like mini lectures with quizzes. And there's nothing wrong with putting good videos online, and I'm very happy that that stuff exists. But to me, the kind of creative intellectual power of a lot of the tools and technologies we have is much broader than that, because it's like it opens up new kinds of intellectual work that kids could be doing, not just new ways of transmitting the same information we've always put in textbooks. And I think Papert has a lot of valuable things to say about that and valuable demonstrations of what that looks like. And we've kind of taken a lot from that over the years.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Of course, it's a pleasure.